funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where does your food come from? It used to be a question we posed to our children to help them understand that milk, meat, and produce come to us from farms rather than simply appearing on supermarket shelves. These days, food miles are a hot topic among Americans looking for ways to reduce their carbon footprints. And what matters to many is how far each bite has to travel to our tables. But while my guest today is himself often a consumer of regionally grown foods, he's concerned that many people misunderstand the benefits of eating local. James McWilliams is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University at San Marcos and this year's winner of the Hyatt Prize in the Humanities. His new book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. James, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
We should start by reiterating that you are not against people trying to eat locally. You just think we need to consider this from a global perspective. Can you talk about that?
No, I definitely appreciate you bringing that up first because, you know, just to criticize the locavore movement is not to say that they haven't accomplished some and absolutely amazing things. And, you know, we are becoming increasingly aware of where our food comes from and how it's produced, primarily because locavores have sort of grabbed us by the lapels and said, look, you got to pay attention to this. And that's all for the good. But yes, when I stand back and look at the issue of sustainable food production on a global level, I stare into a huge problem. And that problem is the population of the world is going to be growing at a very fast rate to about 2060, and we're going to go to about 9.2 or 9.3 billion people. So we have this impending population boom. And then when we look at natural resources, land and water in particular, those resources are tapped out. And therefore, I think, you know, the problem is driven home quite dramatically that we have to figure out how to produce more food with fewer resources. And that's, I think, one of the most pressing environmental challenges we face in the 21st century. Now, pondering that problem and then looking at all the wonderful things that locavores are doing, I have to put the locavore movement in perspective. And what I find is that, you know, this is a step. It's a step in the right direction. It's part of a much more complex approach to sustainable food production, but it's only part, and I think there are other voices that need to be brought into the debate about how we're going to solve this very real problem.
What percentage of a fruit or a vegetable's energy requirements actually are used for transporting that thing to market and then to our houses?
Well, yeah, the food miles issue can be quite distracting, I think, and especially if we're using food miles as a proxy for the carbon footprint of our diet. And I think it's very common, understandably, for a lot of consumers to think if, you know, the food that you're eating did not travel very far, then, you know, then the carbon footprint of your diet is lower than if it did come from a far distance away. The problem with that, with that assumption is that when we stand back and look at the overall energy inputs into food, transportation is really a very small percentage of the energy that goes into producing our food, about 10 to 11%. And what that means is you can confront some pretty counterintuitive situations, such as, you know, if you're buying lamb from the other side of the world that has been raised under pasture conditions, you know, instead of buying lamb locally that would be raised, say, under factory-like conditions, your carbon footprint would be much, much lower if you bought the lamb that was shipped in from the other side of the world. And in the course of my research, I just found a tremendous number of examples where that counterintuitive point was made over and over again. And so I really felt compelled to sort of argue that food miles matter, but not nearly as much as we think.
Yeah, on the surface, for example, it seems logical that an apple that was trucked in from 100 miles away automatically has a smaller carbon footprint than one that we might import from Chile or somewhere. But in fact, those calculations leave some important things out.
Absolutely. You know, we have to also look at the energy inputs into growing those apples and you know, what kind of fertilizer was used and how much fertilizer was used, you know, what kind of pesticides were used, and again, how much pesticides were used. Was there, you know, were they grown in, if we're talking about tomatoes, were they grown under hothouse conditions, which, you know, is an enormous energy boost in terms of what's required to produce the food. And so all of these factors, and of course it only gets more complex when we start talking about, you know, meat and fish and processed foods, because there, you know, there are so many other steps in the supply chain and in the production chain where there could be kind of hidden energy inputs. I mean, in some studies that I looked at, the real energy sink, you know, the place where the energy was lost was the kind of tractor that was used to harvest the particular kind of wheat. And this is both, I think, enlightening and frustrating for consumers, and I'm well aware that we don't have all that information at our fingertips, but I think, you know, down the road, one of the things that we might want to look for from our retailers is some indication of the life cycle assessment, the overall energy input that went into the production of our food, rather than just a marker of where it came from, the distance that it traveled.
So if we're looking at economies of scale here, and I think a lot of people are trying to avoid more processed foods now, but I'm wondering about whether or not we use more energy if we bake a loaf of bread at home from flour that we've purchased somewhere, as opposed to picking one up that's been made with thousands of others in a factory somewhere.
It's very hard to say. You know, it really, there are so many factors involved that, you know, that kind of comparison is... You have to venture a guess, unfortunately, right now, because we lack the information to make those decisions. I think that will change down the road as consumers start to become more savvy about thinking about energy inputs into food. Hard to say right now, but I think one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, economies of scale can certainly, when they're capitalized on efficiently, can certainly lead to energy savings, and it's important to keep this in mind. So, you know, a farmer who takes, you know, 100 apples 100 miles is and sells all those apples is you know, has no less of a carbon footprint than a, you know, a truck that brings 2,000 apples 2,000 miles and sells all those apples. I mean, the key calculation there is the apple per mile or the apple per gallon, and you know, that's, I think, important to keep in mind as well, when so we don't get too hung up on distance, and again, I think it's important that we be willing to take on a little more complexity and do a little more research into you know, how our food was produced. And another point to add on to this is, you know, if it all sounds very daunting, oh my gosh, as a consumer, I've got to do all this research to figure out whether or not I'm eating environmentally. That's true, but on the other hand, you can kind of break this down into some simple rules, and one of them is, you know, pay more attention to what you're eating rather than where it came from. And the reason why I say this is, you know, if you're eating mostly fruits and vegetables, you're avoiding processed foods, you're avoiding meat as much as you possibly can, then your diet's going to be pretty efficient, pretty darn efficient. You know, on the other hand, if you are eating a lot of meat and if you are purchasing a lot of processed foods, the carbon footprint of your diet is going to go up dramatically as a result. So this is a distinction, I think, that is often lost when we just get overly obsessed or fundamentalist about the local.
James McWilliams is my guest. His book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. It really is astonishing, the amount of energy, not just petroleum energy, but food energy that goes into making a pound of certain kinds of meat as compared with a pound of grain.
Yeah, the statistics on meat production are really quite daunting. And I had, you know, I knew going into this research that I would find that producing meat was more energy intensive than, you know, producing grain or potatoes or, you know, crops that are grown for people to eat. But I was still pretty shocked by what I found. Just a few statistics to put this in perspective. You know, 20% of greenhouse gases produced globally come from the livestock industry. More than half the nitrogen fertilizer that is used in the United States, and many of your listeners are probably aware that, you know, nitrogen fertilizer runoff creates terrible problems with aquatic ecosystems, and most notably algae blooms in these dead zones that we're hearing more and more about. 50% of the that fertilizer goes to growing crops that we feed, to animals to drive the meat industry. 70% of the water in the American West, which is already incredibly precious, 70% of it goes to the livestock industry. So what we're looking at here is the foundation of a polluting industrial food system. And it is for this reason that I argue in the book, and I'm well aware that this is not a popular opinion with a lot of people, and perhaps even more so in the state of Texas. But the closer that we can bring our diet to a vegetarian diet, the better our diet will be for the environment. And, you know, again, I have to say this isn't a conclusion that I expected to make as forcefully as I end up doing in the book. But I became quite convinced that if there is any future for sustainable food production, it's going to involve a radical decrease in the amount of meat that we eat.
Well, underscoring your point about livestock and the amount of greenhouse gases that it's generating annually, that 20% is significantly higher than the greenhouse emissions that come from all the vehicles on the earth, trains, planes, and automobiles.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, again, it really reiterates that I know it's very common in certain environmental circles today to drive a fuel-efficient car, and that's clearly a very important thing to do. And often lacking, though, is a similar kind of concern about the place of meat in our diets.
Let's go back for a minute and talk about water, because you mentioned the West and the amount of water that goes to the livestock industry. And there are a lot of people in certain communities who would like to buy things locally without thinking much about the fact that there is a lot of irrigation, supplemental irrigation that has to take place for that to even be possible.
Yeah, I mean, part of my research led me to study a lot of water stress maps. I mean, maps that show where there's a natural abundance of water and where regions are particularly water stressed. And I ended up really questioning, gently questioning, but still questioning the value of localizing food systems in certain parts of the world or certain parts of the United States. And so, you know, when you look at the American Southwest, immediately becomes clear that it's one of the most water-stressed places in the world. And water that would be used to support a revived agricultural system designed to feed local communities. And I should point out that the kind of agricultural system that I think would develop to serve an environmentally minded local community would require a lot less water. But even so, it would still require irrigation. It would still require tapping aquifers. And when I look at that reality in the long term, I have to ask myself, wouldn't it make just as much sense, if not more sense, to try to reform the food system so that we produce the right kind of food, fruits and vegetables that are designed for people to eat, not for animals to eat, that we design the right kind of agricultural systems in places that have comparative advantage, namely an ample water supply, and then figure out how to ship that food, not even necessarily very long distances, but to do it as efficiently as possible. And one way we could do that is to try to transition as much from airplane shipment of food and trucking to rails. I think if there was a revival of shipping food by rails, the energy savings could be dramatic.
James McWilliams is my guest. He's Associate Professor of History at Texas State University at San Marcos. He's also the winner of the Hyatt Prize in Humanities for 2009. His book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. You can join the conversation by calling us now at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James McWilliams, who is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University at San Marcos. We're talking about his book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org. In case, James, we have not yet pushed enough buttons this hour, I want to talk for a minute about people who are eating meat. These days, a lot of people will sort of seek out things called free-range or grass-fed, and you came to some really surprising conclusions about the environmental consequences of something like grass-fed beef.
Well, you know, I suppose it's surprising. I mean, my approach to these issues is, you know, there are just no simple answers, and a lot of times we're dealing with the lesser of evils. And you know, I think that's what grass-fed is. I think if you're going to eat beef, this is absolutely the choice to make because the environmentally, it's much better to eat grass-fed than it is to eat conventional beef. The amount of waste that goes in that is required and comes out of the conventional system is astronomical, and you can have enormous environmental savings by eating grass-fed. That said, I was pretty shocked to find a number of problems that aren't really publicized very often regarding the grass-fed option. The first has to do with methane. Now, the methane cycle is by no means perfectly understood, but what we do know is that cows that are fed a diet predominantly of grass produce four times the amount of methane than cows that are fed conventional grain diets. The problem with that is that methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's 21 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So, you know, we are looking at a greenhouse gas issue when we're looking at grass-fed beef. A study just came out, actually after my book went into print, came out this year, and a Canadian scientist, found that grass-fed beef actually has overall contributes more to, you know, per cow to greenhouse to climate change to greenhouse gases, primarily because than conventional cows. And this really stunned people, and he presented this finding at a conference, and you know, people really, really pressed him. And the bottom line was, he found that a lot of the grass that's used in grass-fed systems, by certainly no means all, but a lot of the grass that's used in grass-fed systems requires fertilizer. Not just growing with the power of the sun, it's growing with the help of fertilizer. And when you factor in the natural gas that's used to produce that fertilizer, the energy costs were astronomically higher. The you know, other point that's rarely mentioned when the grass-fed option is promoted is the fact that when slaughter occurs, about 40% of, and that's generous, about 40% of the animal is actually transformed into edible flesh, and so, you know, 60% has to be dealt with. It has to be recycled or rendered or incinerated. Whatever option is chosen requires enormous energy inputs. And so, you know, I treat this issue delicately because on the one hand, I want consumers to know that this is a better choice. But I also think as consumers, we have to be willing to recognize that even though it's a better choice, it's by no means ideal. And it still comes with a set of environmental problems that could be avoided by really minimizing consumption of that product and eating crops that do not require as much energy and do not create as much pollution in their production.
Some of the same problems apply to the sort of magical buzzword of the 2000s, which is organic food, not just meat products, but also vegetables and fruits. Organic farming is not necessarily a panacea to the problems that we face.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best way to put it. It's not a panacea. The organic farming, you know, I feel this very similarly about the organic approach as I do to the locavore approach. There are tremendous benefits to be gained from this approach to agriculture, and I think, you know, a lot of consumers are becoming increasingly aware of those many benefits. But it's not the be-all and end-all solution. There are still potential problems with organic production. My feeling on this is twofold. I think, you know, one thing we need to recognize is that when we place too much emphasis on the organic solution, we tend to forget, and this is kind of a fine line that I'm drawing here, but we tend to forget that 98% of the food produced in our country is produced through conventional methods. And what I see happening, and I think this is unfortunate, but what I see happening is this kind of stark divide between organic and conventional. And there's this assumption that, you know, organic is good and conventional is bad. The problem with that is that, again, 98% of our food is produced conventionally, and I think we have an obligation to not just ride the organic bandwagon, but to ask ourselves, how can we help provide incentives for conventional growers to produce food in a way that is more eco-friendly? And there are so many options that we are not exploring. For example, how can we get fertilizers that are much more efficient, that do not require as intensive of an application, that have much better rates of nitrogen uptake into plants? How can we get these higher-priced fertilizers into the hands of conventional farmers? They don't have to use as much. How can we encourage conventional farmers to practice integrated, more and more integrated pest management, therefore decreasing their reliance on potentially harmful pesticides and fungicides? How can we get farmers to adopt drip irrigation systems or installing moisture sensors into their crops to cut their water usage by half or even more? So there's a variety of kind of less sexier options that are out there that we're not exploring when we get overly consumed with the organic option. That's one concern. The other concern is that just take organic itself, and you know, again, it's only 2% of the production of the food in this country. If it did really take off, and it's growing 20% a year, I mean, it's growing fast, there are things to be aware of. One is, and this is a very controversial issue, but I feel fairly confident in saying that organic yields on the whole are a little bit lower than conventional. The decision not to use synthetic chemicals can often lead to lower yields. And that's an issue, you know, given the problem we discussed at the beginning of the show. If our challenge is to produce more food on less land, you know, that could be a potential problem if the yield capacity doesn't increase. Another concern is with chemicals. I mean, organic farmers are authorized to use natural chemicals, and a lot of these chemicals are highly toxic and can have negative environmental consequences. Nicotine sulfate, Chilean nitrate are just two examples of chemicals that organic farmers are authorized to use that, you know, right now we don't hear much about them because organic farming is such a small portion of the overall agricultural system. But, you know, as it grows, I tend to think that the concerns would become more evident. And again, we'd be hit with that realization that, hey, this approach has many benefits, but it also has some problems too. A final point about organic is the amount of manure that would be required for compost and for fertilizer is enormous. And the amount that's needed per acre, I don't have the figure at my fingertips, but the amount that is needed per acre, it might be something that could be transported and distributed efficiently in a place like the United States, but in poor developing countries, I am skeptical that there could be an efficient way to distribute massive amounts of this extremely heavy fertilizer source.
And still requires all those methane-producing animals
to exist. Right. So it would require a very careful integration of animal husbandry into traditional crop agriculture.
James McWilliams is my guest. His book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. We'll turn to the phones now and go first to Thomas in Dallas. Hello, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I was going to say that actually in halal markets, at least here in town, you can get goat or lamb that's grown on grass. And as you know from your area, those goats aren't, that grass isn't fed fertilizer down there. And y'all have, you know, seasonal droughts. Here we get better rain. And again, this is grass prairie land, and those grow well here. And in Argentina, they do a crop, rotation of the animals, and that also is very efficient, does not use extra fertilizers or water. And so I know you're speaking broadly, and I would say that, for instance, like Hebrew National is, though kosher, and I don't know if kosher the same way generally, but of course that's what ConAgra, and so that's probably not going to give you the same savings. But some of these smaller local markets, unlike Whole Foods, which again has a huge distribution network, is, you know, are more sustainable. Anyway, so it's just...
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think, you know, a distinction that needs to be drawn is, you know, between these niche production systems that, you know, hey, they're being done in the right place, they're being done in the right way with the system that you're describing right now, and there's a small niche market that will support that. And I think that's great, and we need that. Where that's possible, we need to see more and more of that happen. And again, my perspective on these questions is what happens if you universalize it? I mean, you hinted at that in your question. You know, I'm thinking more broadly about it. And so I then am less optimistic about how these small sustainable systems that are sustainable because they're small and because they can serve just a very small market, a kind of niche elite market. You can't really universalize that. And I, again, my approach is sort of looking at the problem from 1,000 miles up. And so I tend to focus more on the larger conventional systems and highlighting the problems with those systems. I think what you're describing works in certain places for certain people, and I think that's great. We need to support that. But let's be careful about universalizing it as a solution to sustainable meat production.
The other thing that the Thomas's question points up is the idea that if people want to continue eating red meat, perhaps choices other than beef make more sense.
I think any time you can diversify your diet, the better. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Hillsborough and speak with Howard. Hello, Howard.
Hello, how are y'all doing today?
Great, thank you.
Well, let's before I get started, I want to say, let's face it, it's not going to happen in the next year or two. But the thing about going back to rail and getting away from trucks and stuff like that is, really, if you get down to it, it's a joke because, every truck that's on the road pays just on highway use taxes about $15,000 to $20,000 a year. And there's hundreds of thousands of trucks that depend on shipping all this produce and meat and everything else across the country every day. And, you know, there are communities that have grown up just around truck stops all across the West and everything else. And without the trucks on the road, those communities wouldn't be there anymore. So, I mean, you're talking about a big, big cut in all kinds of taxes and jobs and everything else if you start getting away from trucks and back to rail.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the infrastructure in our country is certainly set up to support trucking, and you're absolutely right. Just as the railway did, you know, railways did in the 19th century, and communities developed around train depots, and you know, you're drawing a nice parallel. I think accurately to truck stops. And I really just brought it up as an example to highlight that, you know, we can have. I think the point I was trying to make, and maybe the pipe dream of trying to create a rail system to replace a trucking system is not the best example to use. But what I would say is we have to figure out how to make transportation as efficient as possible. And to me, it makes much more sense to do that than to focus on trying to create these small local systems all over the country to cut out the transportation. So, maybe a better example would be to create hybrid trucks trucks that are far more efficient, get better gas mileage and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean the train example was an extreme way of saying that we should allow the long distance movement of goods and in fact encourage the long distance of goods, but you know, we really need to figure out how to do it as efficiently as possible.
I guess it's also important to keep in mind the fact that although it's easy to romanticize the past and talk about everybody eating almost everything locally, in fact, human beings for some time now have been transporting their food from great distances.
Well, I mean, I'm an agricultural historian, and that's how I come at this issue. I mean, I've spent many, many years studying how farmers produced food and traded food in the 17th and 18th centuries in colonial British America. And one of the things that may shock a lot of people is that while farms were relatively small and there was obviously a great deal of integration into local markets, these farmers were also very interested in getting their goods overseas. They wanted to trade their goods far and wide, and they wanted to buy goods from all over the Atlantic world. And I mean, I found a number of examples in my research of farmers in you know, cohesive Puritan Massachusetts growing food that was needed by the community and selling it to merchants who were selling it in the West Indies because the price was better there. Farming is a cutthroat business, and it really always has been. And there's a great deal of romanticizing the subsistence-oriented, communally oriented family farm of a long time ago. And frankly, I have a hard time finding that farm when I go and study pre-industrial agriculture. It's a very difficult, competitive business, and farmers have always been interested in trying to reach broader and broader markets.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ronald in Fort Worth. Hey, Ronald.
Hey, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
Hey, the reason why I called is because I want to say that I completely agree with your guest there. I think that there is a fine balance that can be struck between foods that are shipped in and possibly foods that are grown in your backyard. I was saying before that I picked grapes on the side of the highway, and I make jelly out of them. It's the best jelly in the world, but that sugar has to come from somewhere because I just don't have the ability to make sugar.
Ronald, let me put you on hold for a second. We're going to come back to this in just a moment. We need to take a quick break. We will be back with Ronald from Fort Worth, back with James McWilliams, who is this year's Hyatt Prize winner in the humanities. His book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University at San Marcos, James McWilliams. He won this year's Hyatt Prize in the Humanities, and his newest book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. We will go back to the phone now. We have Ronald still there in Fort Worth. Ronald, if you wanted to finish up your point.
Hey, I'm still here, yeah. I was saying before that I think there's a fine balance that can be struck here. I have a really cool vegetable garden in my backyard. I grow tomatoes and corn and just all kinds of stuff. But there's certain vegetables that I really like to eat that just don't grow well in Texas. And of course, those are the vegetables that I buy from, you know, the local stores or whatever. But I think, again, like I said, there's a fine balance that we can strike between, you know, the foods that are shipped in and what we grow in our own backyards. And I think that people who are environmentally responsible kind of, you know, without really thinking about it, could do that just fine, you know. And my grandparents grew their own vegetables for years. I don't think I ever saw my grandparents buy vegetables from a grocery store.
Yeah.
I think that's a real possibility.
Thanks very much for your call. What do you think about that, James?
Oh, it's a really refreshing perspective because, you know, what the caller is saying is that it's possible to be local and to be global at the same time. And, you know, one's not necessarily more sustainable than the other. And unfortunately, much of the debate on this issue is not nearly that rational. When it comes to talking about food production in our culture today, the lines are really polarized. I mean, the people are on one extreme of the argument or another. And in a lot of ways, you know, while I completely support what the locavores are doing, I'm really, really, I caution the movement about becoming fundamentalist, because I think when you do that, you then develop an assumption that, you know, somehow food that comes from outside the locality, or the, you know, some food that comes from South America or from Holland or whatever, is somehow inferior. And that's not always a fair assessment. But, you know, we divide the world into organic and conventional, or, you know, free range and factory farm, or free trade and fair trade. Almost any issue has these extremes, and it's usually in the middle where I think the most achievable and beneficial answer lies. So I think the caller's perspective is really a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, you know, people may or may not agree with your conclusions here, James, but it seems to me that it does represent progress, that now at least we all have our terminology on the table. We people know what it is they want to achieve when they're choosing what they want to eat. And it seems to represent progress that at least now we're getting into the nuance of all this and sort of away from the black and white, this is good, this is bad.
Yeah, I do think that's the natural next step. But, you know, it's not an easy thing, because, you know, these issues are very important to people. And I respect that and admire that a great deal. But I also think there is room for sort of stepping back and thinking about our food systems as rationally as possible, and sort of taking the emotion out of it for a moment and asking some very hard questions about how to achieve sustainable food production. And it might lead us to have to entertain some things that we may not have thought about entertaining, or that may even be counter to what we're accustomed to incorporating into our vision of what it means to eat in an ethical fashion.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll go to Celeste and speak with Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good. I'm sitting out here in the middle of one of the last tall grass prairie remnants in Texas, and one of my comments was about free-range grazing, that where I'm sitting, from the coast of Texas all the way up into southern Manitoba, we had about 60 million very flatulent bison, not to mention pronghorn, antelope, elk, white-tailed deer, mule deer that were here. And one of the things that we found is that the grazing actually enhances native biodiversity. Without grazing, it's an absent disturbance regime. So in the absence of grazing, a lot of our high-quality grasslands, such as they are going to be lost. Generally, they were subject to periodic fire and episodic grazing. Where I'm sitting right here is on the state soil of Texas. It's Houston Black, and this stuff will produce upwards of 7,000 pounds of dried herbage per acre in its native state, that is. And there's about another 14,000 pounds of organic material per acre in the soil, which is a tremendous carbon sink. One of the concerns that I have about this, that talking about grazing, consumption of animal products, I don't eat much meat because I've got high cholesterol, but if we start pushing in the direction of additional row crop agriculture, one of the first things that's going to happen is that we're going to look at the conversion of existing grasslands to row crop agriculture, and guess what? There's a tremendous amount of carbon that's mm-hmm. going to be dumped into the atmosphere in that process. So those are my comments, and I'll take your answers off the air. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, Jim.
Okay. The caller makes a great point. Intensive management grazing or rotational grazing can certainly improve ecosystems and can do what the buffalo and the, you know, other animals that used to roam the prairie used to do, and that's you know, build up the organic matter in the soil, improve biodiversity, all of those things. But if that's going to happen, and indeed if we are going to support a system of animal husbandry that honors that balance, and it's really a fine balance that the caller is mentioning, it requires enormous management skill. It is going to require a radical reduction in the amount of meat that we eat, because we couldn't sustain and harvest the sheer poundage of meat that we do conventionally through a rotational grazing system. So I fully agree with the caller that the incorporation of careful and strategic incorporation of grazing into an ecosystem can actually improve that ecosystem. But it is going to require, on the part of consumers, a very, very large reduction in the amount of meat that we eat. Now, the second point about turning over prairie land to more row crops would be, again, alleviated significantly if we hadn't turned over the entire Midwest to growing corn and soy to feed to animals. If that land was taken out of production and used for row crops of diversified plants that were designed to feed people, I think the concern that the caller had would be greatly alleviated. The final thing I'd say here is that much of the Midwest used to be a lush prairie land as well. It was some of the richest soil in the world in the 19th century, and it was it was ruined by irresponsible grazing. It was trampled by cattle, and it was desiccated by growing crops to feed those cattle. So I think what we're talking about here is achieving a really delicate balance. It is achieved in many places, and it's going to have to be accompanied by a different approach to meat from the consumer perspective.
There are, of course, people who argue that no matter what you're growing, there is a possibility that you could use less fertilizer, have greater yields, use fewer pesticides if you consider genetically modified seeds. Now, this is anathema to a lot of people who really want to eat sustainably, but you think there's at least room to listen to those arguments and make sound judgment after considering all the possibilities.
Yeah, I take a pretty nuanced approach to genetically modified crops. The way the technology is currently being employed makes it really hard to support. We have a handful of biotech corporations that are using this very powerful technology to genetically modify a seed to achieve a certain trait. They're using it to essentially grow 3-4 crops, and these 3 or 4 crops are grown monoculturally. And they're grown, in the case of soy and corn, to feed to animals or to feed into this sort of enormous industrial food system that we're all hearing more and more about. So there's very little to complement, at least environmentally, in the current application of genetically modified technology. But I wonder, and this is true for me, I mean, I went into my research really opposed to GMOs, but I came out cautiously optimistic because I started to read about scientists, plant geneticists that were creating genetically modified cassava, which is a staple crop in many parts of Africa, and they were genetically modifying it to be drought resistant. And so the idea of genetically modifying a crop that would lead to higher yields under drought conditions of a staple crop that Africans, developing African countries were dependent on, appealed to me in a different way than genetically modified corn or soy did. And then I did some reading about a genetically modified rice that was blight resistant and would, again, allow for a more stable and higher yielding supply of rice. 25% of the world lives on rice. And that, struck me as something that would tremendously benefit many Indonesian and Southeast Asian countries. And so I could go on and on. I mean, there are literally hundreds of seeds that have been genetically modified to achieve both humanitarian and sustainable outcomes that have not made it onto the market because there's no money in it for the companies that are currently selling these seeds. And number two, some nonprofit organizations that might otherwise try to bring these seeds to developing countries are quite gun-shy about doing so simply because there's so much backlash against it, the Frankenfoods and all that kind of rhetoric. So It's, again, a really fine line here, but I think we are looking at a technology that, if responsibly applied, could have great benefits for the future of sustainable agriculture, especially as climate change becomes an increasing factor in our lives. We're going to see viruses we've never seen before. We're going to see fungal diseases we've never seen before. And if we have a responsible technology that we can use to fight those, I think we shouldn't get rid of it.
We have talked exclusively this hour about land-based food cultivation, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about what you learned regarding fish, in particular, certain kinds of farm-raised freshwater fish.
Yeah, just briefly, before doing this research, when I heard aquaculture, I thought, oh, big, dirty, nasty systems that were sort of the aqueous equivalent of a feedlot. And that comparison is, I think, holds up for like salmon farming or shrimp farming in Indonesia. The press has been, I think, very diligent about highlighting the environmental problems of marine-based fish farming. But when I started to look at freshwater systems, I really discovered the potential, in some cases the realized potential, of growing a tremendous amount of protein, a tremendous amount of healthy protein, with very few resources. And I found this with catfish farming, I found this with tilapia farming, carp farming. And the key issues here involve feed. I mean, if you take salmon, the feed that's required to keep salmon growing is 75% fish meal. So you have to go out and harvest the oceans of these smaller fish lower on the food chain, and process them into this meal and then feed it to the fish. And that, of course, I think compromises the integrity of the system, and it's a lot like growing corn to feed the cattle. However, you know what I found with a lot of freshwater fish systems is a lot of the meal that was used to feed these fish was vegetarian, and so the cost of that meal environmentally is much lower. So tilapia, I think, are completely vegetarian. Catfish are mostly vegetarian. Trout are mostly vegetarian. And the other point to consider is that freshwater systems can be carefully managed, almost like the rotational grazing we were talking about. They can be carefully managed to integrate plants and fish. So actually, fish are able to eat the phytoplankton, and the fish waste can then feed the plants, and you have this polycultural system that leads to a more environmentally correct way of producing protein. We haven't achieved it yet, but I think there's potential to do so.
James McWilliams is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University at San Marcos. His new book is called Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. James, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.